Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
A Man in Winter, the title of the latest chilling novel by critically acclaimed horror writer Katie Marie. And if it gets any more horrific, you could actually say that, well, she's from Norfolk. My word, how shocking is that? Katie Marie, how are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Well, always a delight to feature authors and the Author of the Week feature. It kind of goes together, really. But let's jump straight into yourself from that point of view. I mean, you're a small, noisy creature. I'm using the descriptor on your website here that can be found in Norfolk, England. You have a love of horror that was born with your mum reading Thief of Always by Clive Barker to me at a young age. And when you're not reading, playing, or indeed watching horror, you're usually writing it. Is it a case of that notion? Because as we've said before, we've talked about this at length in previous sessions over the years, really, that arguably Mary Shelley was very much at the forefront of obviously producing that spine-tingling horror with Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus, over 200 years ago now. And then obviously we have the likes of Edgar Allan Poe and Clive Barker, as you mentioned, who've also put that together. I noticed actually in the background here, using the joys of Zoom, is it a Lovecraftian backdrop that you've actually got there with a little Call of Cthulhu?
It's actually just the back of my, this is just my office. Sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied. Yeah, this is just my office. Behind me, I have a poster from the Ye Old Frankenstein Boris Karloff movie. My arm is probably a better indicator of the classic horror. I have tributes to Mary Shelley, Poe, Lovecraft, Robert Chambers, and I have a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde part to my sleeve as well.
A little touch of Robert Louis Stevenson in there as well. So yes, clearly you have actually taken this love of horror that you're, I mean, obviously we blame the parents, that you're clearly your mum actually was responsible for in terms of that. So is it because it's cathartic? Is it because it's fun? Is it because you sort of think, I mean, we'll talk about A Man in Winter in a few moments, because I mean, the horror there in many ways is indicative of the notion that's often put forward that horror cycles tend to emerge in times of social stress. They're a way of actually coping with the insanities and the madness of the world. Is that something that you've found, Katie?
I definitely have. I'm actually really fascinated by why people like horror as much as they do. I've written about it a few times on my website, and there is a marvelous TED talk, and I can never remember people's names, but if you search on YouTube about horror and humanity, I'm sure you'll come across it. And the doctor on that talk speaks at length about how horror helps us confront things within society that we wouldn't be necessarily comfortable confronting head on. He says the campy, almost fun nature of horror allows us to deal with these issues in a way that basically we do it almost gently. Even though horror is famous for being gory and quite brutal at times, the emotional issues you can deal with, it's easier to deal with them under that veil of everything else.
And there is, of course, the actor that actually the most profound and provocative horror, as in the notion of turn of the screw and areas with respect to that, is the horror which is more subtle, that isn't kind of in your face, splatterfest, etc. That actually it's the thing that, as Hitchcock would say, it occurs off screen, that kind of really raises the hackles and so on. Much like living in North Carolina can be the case, now that you're obviously back in North Carolina, as opposed to Dublin. Jessica Burtis, welcome back to Author of the Week, etc. Jessica, any questions you'd like to put to Katie about her life and times?
Well, I have so many, honestly. I'm into horror, so it's really cool getting to talk about your horror book. But I was actually really curious about the dementia aspect of your book, and I would love to know how your research went for that and how you kind of came to the idea of using memory to kind of relate to ghosts.
It started a long time ago. I used to work in the legal profession, and one of the areas that I specialized in, we call it private client. It's things like drafting wills, power of attorney. And through my work there, I came into contact with a lot of people who had had a very recent diagnosis of dementia, and they were all well, they were all very different, but they all had one thing in common, and that is that they were all really, really worried about how their diagnosis was going to affect their families. And they were all the compassion they had was unreal. They were all naturally quite worried for themselves, but the main focus was, what can I do to help my family? What can I do so that they remember me as who I am rather than who I might become under this illness? And I remember seeing, I can't remember which blooming film it was now, but I remember watching films and reading other horror books, and they had characters who suffered mental health, physical disability, dementia, and they were all treated in the same sort of way. They were the thing to be feared, or like the first one to go, quite frankly. They were either the ultimate victim or the monster to be scared of. And that wasn't what I was seeing at all with these people. So when Arthur effectively walked into my head, almost fully formed, he was an amalgamation of all those people I'd spoken to. And I wanted to use him to almost humanize the dementia aspect and show that these were just people. They weren't something to be afraid of. They weren't something to be awkward around. They're just people.
I think that that's a really nice thing to hear. I think especially because I think that sometimes some horror has gotten into the stereotype of kind of harmful ways of representing people for the sake of horror. So it's really nice to see a positive example and that you're using this to kind of help humanize people. And you mentioned that Arthur stepped into your head about fully formed. So I'm curious about how your characterization process goes. How do you start building your characters? Are they always like Arthur, where they kind of just make themselves known?
My strongest ones usually are, but I will also have a process of where I build my characters up. I'll have a small idea for usually a plot, and then the characters will build around the plot, and I'll find somebody who best fits in there. But some of them, like Arthur, I remember the moment I was literally walking home from work, and he walked full, I could see him so clearly. He was sat there in his brownest of brown suits because he thinks he's so boring. And he had his walking stick and his sneaky little hip flask that he thinks that nobody knows about, that everybody actually knows about.
I want to meet Arthur.
He's cool. He's have you ever seen the Disney movie Up
Yes.
with
Oh my
Carl
God, that's
Fredrickson? He When I saw Carl Fredrickson, I was like, oh my God, it's like PG Arthur.
that just
It
makes
was
him
great.
even better.
I know, he's cantankerous, but he cares. He cares so much.
Is there such a thing as tender-hearted horror? Well, there is now. Katie Maurice's Ghost Story, A Man in Winter, connected with me on such an emotional level. Just one of the lines that's come through there, as well as A Man in Winter by Katie Maurice, is a horror story on more than one level, weaving murder in with the tragedy of loss of oneself through dementia. And that loss of oneself is something, Katie, which is again very much at the heart of things, even like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and so on, that when we lose people that we think we know and we feel that they're not them, is that something which is, again, it's one of the key characteristics of horror that I know has often been spoken of. Kim Newman actually in Nightmare Movies was addressing a similar thing. We've also got that whole notion of the philosophy of horror that Noel Carroll put together and how that sort of works. I mean, I was intrigued initially when I saw another text, of course, Firefly. I thought, oh, you're doing an adaptation of the Joss Whedon thing. No, completely different. So just
No.
clarify that. Yeah, it's just distorted on that. But the opening line of that, my name is Rachel and I work for the gentleman. The gentleman has an interest in the paranormal, the unexplained, and the bizarre. He uses his influence and power to investigate strange events and collect evidence. His collection is comprised of this evidence, as well as files and reports of the events. Got to ask, Katie, in terms of obviously your location is Norfolk, England, which is fine. It's always good from that point of view. Do you feel as though there is a distinctive difference between both sides of the Atlantic in terms of, Stephen King, obviously on the East Coast of America, and yourself, obviously, and Clive Barker and company writing, obviously, in Britain? Do you feel that in Britain we have a more gothic approach to horror, or is that a case of no? It's all much of the muchness, really.
I honestly think that with the marvelous invention of the internet, wonderful thing that it can be, I think it's actually horror has become a lot more global now. You do definitely get, though, different flavors depending on your location. I've found, especially watching Korean horror, is definitely got its own flavor, as Japanese horror, horror produced over in America, and horror produced over here. They're all distinctly different. Even without knowing where something has been made, be it a film or a book, you can usually tell quite quickly, not just because of the accents of the characters either. And I, like you say, I find that over here, our horror tends to go in two flavors, and one of them is definitely gothic. And then the other one is trying to think of a good example for it, because I'm dreadful at describing things, which is a wonderful trait for a writer to have, I'm sure. Have you ever seen Attack the Block?
Yes, yeah, urban
Yes.
horror,
Yes,
very much so
that's
from
the
that point
way
of
to
view.
put it. There we go. I find we tend to do quite a lot of that as well. We tend to go for those kind of extremes, whereas America seem to, or at least the stuff I've seen, they tend to focus on a lot more social issues than we do. But also, they seem to be terrified of their small towns. I don't know why. I like their small towns. They look so pretty and so idyllic, but so much horror in America is set in a small town.
Just like Charlotte's North Carolina in many ways. And speaking of Charlotte, North Carolina, I mean, Jessica, are the picket fences, are the white picket fences there? Is it a case of, I don't know where we're going now?
I think since I live in the suburbs, I feel like that's very common in a lot of horror. There's something about it, like the Stepford Wives vibe of the neighborhoods, that scares people with its similarity, I think. There's something
I
uncanny
think
about
it's also something to do with subversion. Horror loves to subvert things. This is why you see so many
it.
scary dolls or scary children. It's that idea that something that looks so idyllic on the surface, the minute you scratch away at it, underneath it's putrid and vile, and we need to show people.
I mean,
I
from
think so.
the time's passed, of course. I think Jessica can hopefully confirm, at least for the visual aspect, the mind's eye, as far as the radio listener is concerned, that this is actually the back of your household in North Carolina. I think you sent it to me once, around about the Halloween time, with, as you noticed, a kind of a disembodied hand there, and arm, so just sort of like Thing from the Addams Family, kind of coming through, which is extraordinary, really, towards the left hand side there. So clearly, she knows of what she speaks on the spaces.
Yes, really.
Katie, do you travel far and wide, or is it a case of, I'm in Norfolk, it is the best part of the world, we've got great turkeys, they're beautiful? Sorry, I couldn't resist it. Where do you actually sort of go? I mean, is it a case of, now that we're obviously post-COVID, the convention circuit is actually going, you say, yeah, get me onto the next ticket, I'll be in the San Diego Comic-Con now?
I love to travel. Traveling is definitely enriching. Just before COVID, my partner and I were so, I say we were so lucky, but I can't think of a better word for it. We were immensely fortunate. We booked a holiday really soon before COVID struck, and we managed to go to, well, I say really soon. It wasn't like the day before or anything. It was a good 6 months before. But we were thinking at the time, like, should we put this off for another year? Maybe. Oh no, let's just go. And we went off to Norway to go and see the fjords, and that was absolutely marvelous. It's a gorgeous place to go. And then we came home, and 6 months later, it's like, yep, can't leave your house for like 2 years now. You're trapped forever. I'm sick of my house now. And just recently, we went to Rome last month to see, well, Rome. And that was wonderful. My partner's really into ancient history. And I was, I've always been captivated by things like Herculaneum, which is like Pompeii, in the sense that Vesuvius popped off, to put it mildly, and it's perfectly preserved. And it's really harrowing to be able to walk around in a place like that and see almost like a snapshot of the disaster. It's really strange how you can go from walking around all these ancient buildings and seeing all this so well preserved, like the decorations on the walls are still there. There's still paint on the walls. It's amazing. And then you go down to the boathouses, and it's like, oh yeah, something absolutely unbelievably horrible happened here. And you're really put into the minds of the people as they were running down this really narrow, I couldn't get over how narrow it was, the walkway, and there's a tunnel down to the the boathouses, and it's narrow and it's dark, and you get sucked into the moment. You could almost hear the volcano going in the background, and all of the ash raining down and the debris, and it gave me chills just being there. But yeah, on a more cheerful note, travel is wonderful.
Just as you were saying that, Katie, I was minded of course, we are 75 years from the, or just over, the Hiroshima nuclear bomb explosion, which again has often been compared in its kind of impact, no pun intended, to the shock, obviously, of the Pompeii scenario. In fact, as I say, we were recently featuring a concert that was developed to commemorate, in fact, the sound of the trees as they grow via one of the composers who effectively had actually captured the sound of the trees, and obviously the connection. And apparently, 75 years ago, at the time of the actual explosion, there's just silence. You could normally hear the sort of growth of it, but there was just total silence on that system. So, maybe that's another area where, to say what we were discussing earlier, the way in which horror can be used to work out things, to address things. I mean, sadly, we have the tragedy of the Titan and the submersible that obviously has had a catastrophic implosion.
Yes,
Again,
yeah, it's
that is
awful.
another classic horror trope of the haunted house, but lifted to a different area. And I'm sure the writers will be talking about, and of course, the sea has its wealth of horror stories. Arguably, the Titanic disaster itself was a horrific tale.
Yes, yeah. Speaking of the Titanic, I recently went to the theatre to see it on the stage, and it was amazing how they did the bit where the iceberg was looming, and then it obviously the ship hit it. And they used sound so well in that moment as well. They had like the music swelling, and they were taught this. They were singing, because it's a musical, about how you couldn't see like your hand in front of your face, how still the waves were, and how there's no air, and it was so quiet. And then you had like the music swelling up and swelling up and swelling up, and then there was like a big crescendo where they hit, and then it was just silent, and they used the sound absolutely amazingly. It was so tense, even though you knew it was coming. It was perfectly executed. Marvelous show.
Interesting in a whole range of ways, but you talked about music. Let's talk music now. Some writers like to have a soundtrack. They have their iPods or equivalents all lined up. They have their playlists sorted and so on. I mean, you've won Douglas Barber Award for speculative fiction. Obviously, you've produced a whole range of things. Is there a go-to artist or genre or area that you think, yep, without this, Katie cannot produce greatness?
I am at heart a metalhead. So I really, really enjoy my heavier music. I recently went to see the Who on stage history earlier this week. I was there on Wednesday. They're a Mongolian metal band, and they're fantastic. And I will often, when I'm writing, sometimes I will need music to help. And it is often either the heaviest thing I've got on my iPod or the complete opposite. It's literally like chill jazz with coffee shop noises in the background. It really depends on what scene I'm trying to write. And if it's something a bit more mellow, a bit more chill, then it will definitely be my smooth jazz in the coffee shop. And if it is something a bit more dramatic or a bit more character driven, it will often be something a bit heavier. But I find if I get stuck, I will go out in my car and put something really, really loud on. I am that obnoxious, horrible person that everyone hates who drives around with their music really loud. I do keep my windows up though, I promise. And I'll bomb
It's
around.
Norfolk, Katie.
Well,
Anything goes in Norfolk, so I've been told. So,
there's hardly anybody here.
exactly.
There's lots of big open space. It's fine, really.
You got Ely, you got a few cathedrals. That's basically it, really. It's just a whole lot
That's
of
it.
things there.
We're all teeny weeny. It's lovely. There's so much open space. So once you hit like the dual carriageway and you're well out of town and you can go fast in your car with the really loud music on, I find that sort of it's almost like it cleans your brain and it frees up for much more creative thought. So yeah, music's great.
You've got short stories, you've got a YouTube channel, we've also got texts such as Shadows Beneath the Surface. Armental, the pronunciations right for that. The Water series, of course, is there. Where should the novice reader for the Katie Marie universe, where would you point them to start off with to actually say, well, start off with that, use that as the gateway, and then see where it takes you?
I would probably start off with some of the short stories. I tend to struggle a little bit with longer fiction, although I am trying to, I have a novel out to agent at the moment. So I would definitely start off with the shorter fiction. I would probably start with the Water series, the Siren Selkies and Sea Monsters. That's an amazing book with so many other amazing authors in there, hence why I think it won the Douglas Barber Award, like you mentioned earlier. And I'm particularly proud of that one as well. So I would start there. I would also check out the Horrorzine. They're a fantastic website and they're free to read as well. And they do so much good horror stuff. And I've been fortunate enough to be published by them a couple of times now. Their book of ghost stories, which is my bragging rights book because it was reviewed by Owen King, who is Stephen King's son and co-wrote Sleeping Beauties with him. So that's like whenever people are like, what's your biggest thing as a writer? I'm like, oh, Owen King read one of my books. So that's very cool. That's also an amazing book. It's also been turned into an audio book. So you don't even have to read it, you can listen to it.
Good stuff. Okay, well, Jessica has now got what we refer to in this particular feature as the ultimate question regarding nutrition and the writer. And it's going to be particularly interesting because normally she's throwing these at citizens of either Canada or indeed North America in various ways. So there's a kind of heads up there in some ways. So occasionally it goes, and I think it's quite some time, Jessica, since we actually had a British author to actually throw this
Yeah,
little question to. So could be quite
definitely.
interesting. Over to you, Jessica.
Yeah, so I would love to know if you have ever heard of or tried sweet tea or boiled peanuts, which are both snacks from the states where I live. Have you ever tried them, possibly?
I have not. I'm intrigued, though.
They would be excellent as a little thing to help you write. Metal music, some boiled peanuts. Some sweet tea. It's really good. Sweet tea is just cold black tea with a bunch of sugar added. It's like a little dessert, the most beautiful thing. You should definitely try it if you ever come to the States. It's excellent.
I will. It sounds lovely. I do like a lot of sugar.
You could have a sweet tea with
That
Owen King. And it would bond you for life, you see. You know, he
sounds
likes your book, move to the sweet tea, and happiness will ensue, I'm sure. It's great
That
stuff
would be
that.
amazing.
Yeah. So what does the future hold for Katie Marie then? I mean, writers writing, if you write, you write, it's like breathing, it's natural, it's what you do, it's an essentially. Is that the kind of line that you're looking to develop that already you've got? You'd said about, oh, obviously earlier in terms of A Man in Winter that Arthur formed was fully formed, etc. Are there other characters that you can't even reveal at present that you think, yeah, I think so and so will actually come up, we'll work through that? Is there any temptation to actually start having a Katie Marie verse where you have characters interplaying from different books and different texts and different narratives? The multiverse seems to be in vogue these days, so that's all part and parcel of the whole thing. Where will you be taking yourself?
Oh, I would love to have a Katie Marie verse. That would be super cool. Probably dark as hell, but still super cool. I tend to struggle to write series. Most of my books end where they end. There's a very definitive ending. Like if anybody picks up Man in Winter, you'll definitely see that there's the ending is the ending. There's definitely got not going to be a Man in Winter
It
too.
ends with spring, obviously.
There we are. See, there we are. It goes into spring and then nothing happens ever again. Yeah, so I tend to write around themes. I'm particularly keen on writing things like I said, the Man in Winter is about dementia and that side of mental health. I hesitate to call it mental health because it is actually an illness, but psychological side of it. And then my next book is touches on alcoholism, and then my one after that focuses around anxiety. So all my books are tied together through like mental ailments, as it were. So if any of my books sort of crossed over and I did have a little multiverse going on, I think all my characters would probably meet in various forms of therapy.
You could have the therapist as the link, the kind of
This is it.
the narrator.
I could go down like a Dark Anthologies style, the video game with the curator. He opens up every story and then you play through. Cool.
Exactly.
Awesome. I'm stealing that idea.
We always like to feel there's a bit of productivity that comes through. Jessica, questions for yourself.
I'm really curious, since your book is about ghosts, do you believe in ghosts?
I am on the fence, to be honest with you. I don't like to say I don't believe in ghosts because, hell, I don't know enough about the living world, let alone the dead world, to make a solid yes, there are definitely no ghosts. But at the same time, I've seen so many charlatans try and exploit people and exploit people's grief that it just makes me deeply uncomfortable. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't like to say yeah, there definitely isn't, but I can't say there definitely is either. I've never had a ghostly experience myself.
Although,
Are
to be
there
fair,
any? No.
in high technology terms, what we're doing now would be deemed the work of the devil in previous generations, communicating across different countries. What?
Yes. Witchcraft.
Sorry, Jessica, go on.
Oh, I was just curious. Are there any kind of horror-ish or ghost-related stories around your hometown that kind of inspire you at all?
Yes, we actually we went on a ghost hunt quite recently. Not la Was it last year or was it the year before? Goodness me, time is such a lie. One of my friends is a very strong believer in ghosts, and we went to support my friend. And the store we went up to Gressing Hall Workhouse, and the stories they were telling were really, really interesting. And of course, we've got the things like the legend of Black Shuck, which I think quite a lot of England has their own Black Shuck, which is of course the big ghostly dog that wanders around. I have actually done a series on my website called Haunted Norfolk, where I go around different places in Norfolk and tell the ghost stories. We went to a ruined church, which has a gigantic tree growing up through the ruins. It literally bursts through what's left of the ceiling, and that's known as the witch's leg because a witch put a curse on the church because they like screwed her over a little bit. So she was like, right, tree for you.
Have you ever thought about setting one of your books in your town?
I would be worried about setting it in my town because I think I'd get something wrong. Or some I'd misname something and I'd be like called out and then I'd just be so embarrassed. I wouldn't mind setting it somewhere like my town, but maybe called something slightly different. So instead of Norwich, it would be like Nor, second word, witch, spelt completely differently, but still Norwich.
You're far too young
Thank
to
you.
remember a show called The Sale of the Century, in which they started off inevitably with it's the quiz of the week from Norwich, which was fantastic. The Sale of the Century. You can probably find it on YouTube, but there we are. Maybe you can combine your own YouTube stuff with some clips of Nicholas Parsons doing the quiz of the week from Norwich, Anglia Television. A huge oh about that.
I do remember the Granada studio. When I first moved down here, we had the there was a big TV studio right in the center of the city. It was always such an impressive building.
Yeah. Still, you have University of East Anglia, which is bankrupt, but that's all good. So all's well with the world. Only kidding. It's an education of the world today. We're all being replaced by ChatGBTs, so it's the way forward. Which brings us neatly around to that other question. What about the artificial intelligence line, Katie? I mean, I always feel now, and I'm doing it quite frequently, as Jessica will attest to, I have to say to the listener, as far as I'm aware, we are all real live human beings. We're not actually artificial intelligence in generative programming transforming form. Any thoughts on that? I mean, the
Yeah.
notion of let's just type in these characters, bang, there's the novel done in 5 minutes.
I'm so tempted to put like a cat filter on now and be like, I'm not a cat, really. But yes, with regards to things like ChatGPT, I'm not entirely certain what's going on there, to be honest with you. I can't imagine AI will ever replace an actual human writer because It's just an algorithm. Well, I say it's an algorithm. It's taking from things that already exist and like cobbling them together badly in some cases and rather well in others. And there's always like a uniqueness that's with books. Oh no, you've turned into a cat.
Sorry, I just couldn't resist it. I felt being drawn into that particular aspect. So it was just too much for me to actually. I realized the radio post was saying, "What? What?" And I'll simply say, "Meow." Carry on.
Your shirt. Oh
Anyway,
dear.
yes, back to the interview. In
Yes,
terms of
yes.
that, yes. Yeah, so ultimately, you feel that actually we don't have any, or horror writers don't have anything to necessarily fear about
I think I'd be more worried about copyright claims. I'd be more worried about having my work pinched by ChatGPT than ChatGPT turning around and being like, haha, no more writing job for you.
yeah, interesting side of things. Almost at the end of this whole sort of sequence of that movie. How do you relax, Katie? What are the sort of go-to? I mean, do you sort of, well, of course I read more horror, or is there something else that I like to meditate on existential psychoanalysis? I mean, is it something else from that point of view that you kind of unwind when you're not locked into the typing scenarios?
As I tend to play violent video games as my relax. I have protected time every week. So every Sunday afternoon, I sit down in front of the television and I will play video games, usually a horror video game, just because I am obsessed. I do read a lot of horror. I tend to read in the evenings, though, before I go to bed, which is obviously the best time to read horror. But yeah, to relax, I will tend to play a game either where, well, your main character is at risk of something horrendous happening to them. The Alien game was really, really good for that. They did disempowerment so well. Alan Wake was also one that was really, really good. Also about a writer who ended up having to face boogies in the woods. That's an amazing game. If anybody's interested, you should totally check out. The sequel's coming out soon. I'm so excited. But I also really like the games where it's like a power fantasy. I love things like God of War, the latest God of War game, where you get to run around in the Nordic woods as this big buff Greek Spartan, just destroying your way through things. It's a lot of fun.
Sounds like a foreshadowing of Jason and the Argonauts, an
Kratos
upcoming
is
Resident
something
3
else,
wide.
man.
Very true. And in terms of the technology, are you a pen and ink person, or is it a case of no, I like the typewriter, or are you word processor all the way?
I'm word processor all the way. I am dyslexic, and if I wrote with a pen, nobody, myself included, would be able to read what I'd wrote. The same goes for typewriters. I love the noise, but I couldn't use one to save my life. What I wrote would be gobbledygook. And every time you make a mistake, you have to start the whole page again. It's crazy.
Well, to quote from Owen's dad, it could be just red rum, red rum, red rum, red rum. Well, several pages of the whole thing.
There you go.
There we
Why
are.
not? See, in a word processor, at least you could copy paste. On a
It's
typewriter, you've still
true.
got to hit every single key.
Very true. Up next, Professor Bruce Hood, Professor of Happiness, will be talking about what we need to make us happy and what he's found out actually makes us most happy. But before then, Katie hasn't quite finished yet because Jessica has two final questions to put to you, and these could be critical deal breakers. So if you're braced for this in the joys of Norfolk, Jessica will deliver them across the Atlantic.
Yes, very important. Katie, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
I have had a lovely time. It's been an absolute delight. Thank you.
Excellent. And will you be joining us again soon?
I would love to.
Yay!
You passed the questions.
Exactly.
Hooray!
All
Absolutely.
good. Actually, Katie, would you like to just share with us how can people follow you on social media and so on? Do they just type in Katie Marie writer to the relevant search boxes and magic will ensue?
That is exactly what you do. I am Katie Marie Wright or Katie Marie Writer at various places. My website is katiemariewriter.com. It's all nice and straightforward.
I think it was the late comedian Ken Dodd who said he thanked the world that he'd been blessed with more than his share of happiness. Well, maybe he was actually happy because he'd kept a few extra pounds in his savings pot, although given his challenges with respect to inland revenue, maybe that's something we shouldn't go down. However, what the hey? Half the nation say that getting a good deal on their household bills provides the biggest happiness boost, even more than petting a puppy or getting a hug. Can this be true? Well, somebody who might just have some insight in terms of whether it's all about the endorphins and how that can develop is the UK's very own Professor of Happiness at the University of Bristol. That's Bruce Hood. How are you, Bruce?
I'm fine. Very good to speak to you, Alex.
Excellent. So share with us this research that's come through Money Supermarket, etc. Why is this such an important part of the whole notion of feeling good? Is it just a case of we love a bargain, we like that sort of sense of wow, we're ahead of the game here?
Well, I think finances figure prominently in our well-being because it's a constant concern, especially during the current, financial crisis. So money issues figure prominently in our happiness, and the more that we can take control of our spending, the happier we will be. Because it's when we're not in control, we feel that things are getting out of hand, that tends to make us anxious. So sites like comparison sites like Money Supermarket provide tools for optimizing your spending, and that puts you back in control, and therefore it contributes to your sense of happiness.
Were you surprised that it actually exceeded having a hug or indeed having a puppy? I mean, I thought they were kind of done deals that when we were looking for happiness and so on, those would
Well,
essentially be way up there.
it does depend on who you're speaking to. For some people, their pets are the center of their lives, but not everyone has a pet. Having hugs is also really important. But again, I come back to the point that feeling in control is really important on a day-to-day basis. Actually, weather was one of the other interesting aspects, sunny weather. But eventually, you get used to that sort of thing, whereas financial concerns never really go away. So that's why it's important to kind of be mindful of your spending.
I mean, as Professor of Happiness, do people come to you and say, "What is the secret, Bruce? Tell us, share with us. How can we be happy?"
Well, yes, that's true. I teach a course at the University of Bristol called the Science of Happiness. And in addition to all the sort of science and the brain imaging and all the work behind that, they want to know what the practical tips are. So as part of the course, we teach them a whole series of activities that they can do, which are backed by evidence and shown to improve happiness. So yeah, actually, people do ask how to be happy. Although I would say being happy is a concept, it's like health, isn't it? It's something you've got to pursue, because unless you keep up with these habits, you will become unhealthy. In the same way, being happy is really about being happier, which is about how to build resilience, how to deal with things, challenges that give you, a greater sense of satisfaction.
Quantifying the qualitative is something that I spend much of my life battling against in terms of higher education, but that's by the by. Let's talk a little bit about some of the data that this survey actually produced. That when it comes to discounted products, apparently 25% is the sweet spot. That's the minimum that people need to be happy. A quarter off. Almost half of people basically would effectively like to put that into a savings account as well. That also creates happiness. I mean, sometimes you could say, well, surely it means, does that mean if you get up to 50% off a product, you'll get even more better? Is there kind of an exponential rise in terms of how much discount there actually is until ultimately it's free, in which case total happiness is achieved?
I don't think so, actually. I mean, that's an interesting question that you put it that way. I would imagine that whenever you think that you've made a bargain, then that in your brain triggers this cost-benefit analysis. And we know that whenever we get something slightly at a bargain or cheaper than we expect, that gives a little boost to the sort of the dopamine system, which is very popular at the moment. And dopamine is a chemical in the brain which motivates us towards goals. Now, if something is 100%, if it's free effectively, I think that might be a boost, but I don't think it's the same as a noticeable kind of benefit. When you've actually worked to get something slightly cheaper, I suspect you probably experience a much greater boost than getting it for free. And we know that's the case, that very often when you hand out things, gifts for free, they're not as appreciated as much as when you've worked for something and you've managed to get it at a bargain. And that's why Money Supermarket is a really useful tool for doing that, because it provides you with all the information to make those sorts of comparisons. I call it considerate consumerism, thinking about what you're spending your money on. And that's important to the sense of control I mentioned earlier.
45 to 54-year-olds apparently are the most unhappy with their financial situation. Is that because of children or just a case of, well, that's life?
I think that's life, and partly children. But also, I think at that age, you're starting to, you know, you've got your long-term planning. You've got mortgages, of course, which are currently in the news. So I think there's a lot of pressure that is upon that age range. But actually, all of us suffer to some extent. But I think the important point is, irrespective of the economic climate, we can do little things to give us a boost of happiness. And as I suggested, you know, thinking about how you're spending your money, being more thriftful, mindful purchasing, all these sorts of tips surrounding money are ways to which to boost your happiness. So although we can't control the economic environment, we can make little things, changes in our lives, which make a difference.
Personally, I find happiness can be found by a good, lucid, well-written student essay, as opposed to one which has got so many typos and misuses of the apostrophe, it could have been written better by ChatGPT. But maybe that's just me. I don't know. It's just another line. What about yourself? What makes you happy, Bruce?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's teaching students who are engaged and considerate and who really benefit from what I have to tell them. So that's personally, that's what I, as an educator, that's what I do.
And that's almost priceless. Let's be honest. Let's work on that basis. But there we are. Bruce, where can people find out further details about this money supermarket survey in terms of happiness?
Well, there's a website, moneysupermarket.com, and it's /mission-billion, because that refers to the £1 billion they saved customers last year. But what's really cool about this site is there actually is a quiz on there based around some of my tips about happiness and the survey. And if you take part in the quiz, Money Supermarket will donate £1 to charity. So not only are you learning yourself, but you're actually helping others out as well. So I think it's a win-win situation for everyone.
Very much a feel-good way of passing it forward. Bruce Hood, Professor of Happiness at the University of Bristol, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on and stay happy, Bruce.
Thanks, Alex.
Traffic is making me sick. Boy, I can't wait to have you near. I gotta hurry, hurry, hurry now. Quick, quick, quick. Just step on the gas, cause I don't wanna miss this. This opportunity will only come once in my life. My life. I gotta hurry, hurry, hurry now. Quick, quick, quick. Just step on the gas, cause I don't wanna miss this. See what you're bringing me, boy, it's priceless. I gotta be out of my mind not to try this. Through strength I found love. In time I found myself in happiness with you. Through strength I found love. In time I you can give to me. I can feel it when you're holding me close.
You're like one of the world wonders. I know I'm going under. Come see that I'm ready for this. And you're so good for me. You're my true joy. You make me want to say
now, the days when you used to think about Amazon as being a long river in the Southern Americas have long since gone, because actually, if we look at the way in which Jeff Bezos's company has actually grown, quite literally exponentially over the last few years, we've got some very interesting numbers. In fact, since 2010, the organization has invested $4.2 billion to support UK authors, creators, artists, producers, production professionals, and more across the creative industries. That's £4.2 billion, with this year 100 new apprenticeships being created and 250 traineeships designed to improve access to film and TV jobs. How does this impact your average British citizen? Well, we're delighted to actually welcome somebody who hopefully has benefited with respect to this. That's Lisa in Hull. How are you, Lisa?
Hello, I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. Now, would you like to just tell us first and foremost how you have benefited from being a creative with respect to this investment from Amazon? It's fair to say you haven't received all £4 billion yourself.
No, I haven't. Now, that would have been good, wouldn't it? It's more the support that I've had because I'm a small business based in Hull. And when I started out, it was very difficult to get established as a small business. So I joined Amazon Handmade and it just literally got our business started. It really went from selling 10 crochet kits a week to selling 100 a day sometimes. So it just gave us that boost to, you know, to get us noticed and to get people to find our lovely kits.
I mean, you really mentioned that because we've literally just come off the back of the Lincolnshire show. We've got the Great Yorkshire show coming through. Obviously, we meet an awful lot of creatives and craft people within those shows and the agricultural format and so on. But inevitably, they need that initial boost to keep them going. I mean, it used to be a case of where you've got to have a website. You've got to be able to actually deal with respect to online, the various sort of shopping routines you can actually use. Do you feel that Amazon actually have been a major asset to you in terms of doing this? And indeed have helped in terms of guiding the business and improving it?
They certainly have, because I used to be a mortgage advisor, so I've never run a business before. So it was all brand new to me. So I didn't really know anything about marketing. It's one of those things that you learn as you go. So when we set off, it just took such a long time to get established as a small business, but it just gave us a massive platform. So we were literally going from being in front of a few people to being in front of, you know, millions of people worldwide. So our sales started slow and then just took off. So it's really helped us grow our business. We used to be based at home and now we've got our own office and, you know, a couple of staff. So it's really made a massive difference.
Although working from home is still an option, I think, which is well worth noting, but that's another line entirely. Amazon, as we said, one of the leading contributors to the UK creative industries. Were you surprised by these figures or did you think, it's more than just basically getting packages sent to you and, of course, being able to access all sorts of TV content through their Amazon Prime facilities?
I didn't realise just how much they'd done a couple of years ago, but then with me being on Amazon, I do see quite a lot of information coming through. They're often offering apprenticeships, offering all sorts of different facilities for creatives to get involved in. So I've been trying to get involved with as much as I can. And I've had quite a few opportunities. We had a celebrity that runs some stories, making one of our bunny kits. And sales went through the roof again. We're on holiday, and we came back to literally hundreds of orders. And that was another opportunity that came through Amazon, which that is something as a small business I would not have had without them.
You're based, of course, in God's own county, Yorkshire, the joys of Kingston upon Hull and areas with respect to that. As we always used to say, it's never dull in Hull. There we are. But in terms of that sequence, you mentioned you were a mortgage advisor beforehand. Was this an ambition that you'd always had, but you weren't sure how to start? Or was it just a case of, well, you know, you wanted to get in touch with your creative side?
I've always had an interest in crafts. Even when I was a child, my mum taught me to knit. And I wanted at one point to have my own craft shop when I grew up. I went through lots of different things. I wanted to be a teacher or all sorts of different options. But I even started making things at home, and my mum used to take them to work to sell for pocket money. And I must have been about 10 at the time. So I think the idea was in my head right from being a young child. So I did different jobs for a lot of years, and I was working quite long hours. And when I became a mum, I thought I didn't want to be working every weekend. I'm not able to go to things at school. So I thought I'll do something from home, set up my own business. But I wanted to do something that I was really interested in, you know, something I was passionate about, because then it doesn't feel like work. So I just got involved with crafts. And just decided to, you know, to try it and just set up a business, no, not realizing just, you know, just how it would grow.
Now, we talk about the socials, we talked about Amazon, obviously, in the assistance with respect to that. But I mean, you've got your TikToks, you've got your Instagrams, you've got your Pinterest, you've got all of these kind of things, many of which would say you've got to use this, etc. I've often thought that actually, for most craftspeople, if you spend all your time doing the socials, you wouldn't have any time to actually build the things or deal with the crafts in the first place. Do you sometimes find that overwhelming with so much out there?
Oh, I do sometimes, because it's a matter of having to. I do enjoy the socials to some extent, but I've joined TikTok, and that's something I feel a little bit strange doing, because it's, you feel a little bit conscious on camera. But I have been doing more videos, more reels, and we have a brilliant Facebook group, which is quite it's all-inclusive, really friendly, lots of people get involved, and it's a real community. You know, we found a lot of people have joined it, especially during lockdown, and said it was just a lifesaver to have that online community. So we do as much as we can on social media. I think it's one of those things that you have to do these days. That's how a lot of people find new businesses.
And as we said, Amazon, one of the leading contributors to the UK creative industries. Do you feel that actually, from your own point of view, it's basically something which has become a bedrock now? Is it a case of, yeah, next up you'll be going up with Jeff Bezos on a rocket, a bit like William Shatner?
I think it is, yes. I think Amazon is, it's great that they're investing so much in creatives, because I think a lot of people don't take creative businesses as seriously as other businesses. They see it as maybe a hobby or a sideline. But I think they've brought it to the forefront and give a platform on Amazon Handmade to all those creatives, to give them a big platform to get out there and get the businesses seen. I'm not sure about going up in a rocket there. I'll leave that to some other people. But
okay, well, you're now on the Madrid Drive for Siren Radio. How can people from our list base actually access your own work? What's the best way to reach you?
If you literally Google We Woolly Wonderfuls, we should come up. We have our own website, and we're on Amazon, obviously, as well. And we also do things like great beginner kits. So if you want to get into knitting or crochet and you've never done it before, we have some beginner kits which have everything that you need in the kit, and also video tutorials step by step. So we try and make it as easy as possible for people, you know, to get into crafts.
At this rate, you'll be getting bigger than Amazon. But what would your advice be, Lisa, if somebody was listening to this and they're maybe umming and ahhing about the whole thing? What would you suggest they should actually do? Apply themselves onto the Amazon platform or sort of just literally take it elsewhere?
No, definitely. Definitely. It just gives you such a huge platform. I don't think there's anywhere else that you could get such a big platform to be seen. So I'd say go for it. Definitely.
Well, Lisa from Wee Woolly Wonderfuls, huge thanks from that point of view. I was thinking about a nursery rhyme, basically, Wee Willy Winky, who kind of ran through the town. Was that in any way inspirational to the line, or no? It's a completely different Wee Woolly as opposed to Wee Willy.
No, it wasn't actually. I just really like the word wee because it sounds like something small, something cute. And then the woolly, obviously, because it's knitting and crochet. And wonderful, just because it's just a woman.
They are, clearly. Exactly. Lisa from Hull, which is always wonderful. Take care and continued success in all your work.
Thank you very much. Lovely talking to you.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul. Happiness to me is an ocean tide, a sunset fading on a mountainside, a big old heaven full of stars above, when I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere. A wise old man told me one time, happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.